Hey guys, welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of the audio lectures for the ACPT. We are looking at the ACE Personal Trainer Manual, looking towards chapter 14 on page 512. All right guys, so chapter 14 is all about exercise and special populations in a sense that what is necessary to keep in mind and program for regarding anyone that has any sort of health condition or any condition in general that might require altering exercise for. So when it comes down to this chapter, as you look to page 512, you're going to see a list of all the, we'll say, issues or a list of these special populations right there. And there's a total of about 20 or so. But really when it comes down to training special populations, the best thing you can do is revisit this chapter in a sense that you're most likely not going to train these types of clients. Some people might have some conditions and you may be working with people with several of these conditions, especially if you plan on working with an older population or specifically in a medical facility. But as a normal personal trainer going to work at a typical gym, you're not often going to see these special populations as they typically are more referred to a medical health or fitness program with doctors and appropriate supervision to make sure that they are performing exercise, we'll say, safely and under in a medical situation that would assist if something were to go wrong. So really, the way that I'm going to present this chapter is going to be more based on describing what the condition is and just a little bit about the condition and then really focusing on the exercise guidelines. And as far as the test questions, which are about 8 to 10 or so in this chapter, those typically are going to be more around the exercise guidelines what certain things would apply to certain populations. And let's go ahead and actually get started on page 512 and just kind of talk about a little bit. I mean, the main thing as a personal trainer that you're aware of is attempting to make sure that nobody has or that nobody with cardiovascular disease, which include things like heart disease, stroke, and high blood pressure, is overexerting themselves or even that they're being put at higher risk for cardiovascular disease. Since that is the number one cause of death for both men and women, the real, we'll say, issue with anything around special populations is ensuring that you don't push someone close to the intensity levels that might create some sort of event associated with those conditions. So just looking over actually at page 512, the types of populations that we're going to be talking about are going to be cardiovascular disease, maybe high blood pressure, stroke, high cholesterol, peripheral vascular disease, osteoporosis, arthritis, low back pain, diabetes, the different types of diabetes, metabolic syndrome, obesity, youth, older adults, asthma, cancer, all the populations that you might come into contact with, ACE is going to attempt to show you. So as you look over to page 513, I do want to point out that there's a specific, we'll say, acronym used as far as providing someone in special populations with a fitness program. And specifically that's called SOAP, S-O-A-P, and that stands for Subjective, Objective, Assessment, and Plan. And this really comes from the American College of Sports Medicine, in a sense that they want to know what is the issues that you're having and what subjective information can you gather, what objective information can you gather that might further help you understand what's going on, then assess them at their current status, and then create a plan for them to effectively, we'll say, assist them in symptom relief or encouraging the reduction of the symptoms or even diseases that are present. So yes, SOAP, you may hear that in especially around the special populations spectrum of training in the field, and especially around medically supervised training programs. So yeah, just something to point out there, that that's kind of the main way that you go about creating a plan of action for someone in the special populations. So what a lot of the special populations are going to hinder people from performing their activities of daily living. And this is one thing that's kind of one of the main goals for all special populations, is just to ensure that they can exercise and stay in shape enough, depending on their disease, to continue to live their lives independently. And that's most people that are currently living independently, regardless of the special population that they're in, are typically going to be cleared to work with a personal trainer. If someone is not living independently and they do require assistance, then most likely you will not be seeing that person in a personal training setting or fitness setting, because they will most likely be in a medically supervised program. So let's go ahead and flip over to page 514. They're going to talk about the basic guidelines for all of these issues that are all bulleted there: osteoporosis, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, weight management or weight loss, and for obesity, asthma, metabolic syndrome, stroke, hypertension, coronary artery disease. And really, in the expanded knowledge section, they kind of get into people in these populations are not, we'll say, going to be, or sometimes, or oftentimes they are going to be dealing with higher levels of stress. Specifically, because they are working with a condition or living with a condition, they typically are going to have higher levels of physical and emotional stress due to the fact that they are constantly dealing with this. So a lot of times, you know, assisting clients with coping is one of the main jobs of the personal trainer, in assist of coping with their current condition. And specifically, it tells you to establish rapport and allow or basically get to know the person, ask them questions in order to assist them with understanding how much stress they're under, the behaviors that they're currently partaking in, and then assist them with maybe any situations that might be toxic and leading to negative consequences associated with the issue or the condition that they're in. So this also means that these populations might be at higher risk for depression because they might often be in pain, and a constant level of depression and stress lead to anxiety that all can kind of snowball into this, we'll say, mentally unmotivated and less happy of a person. So yeah, just keep that in mind. That one of the major reasons that we're in, or one of the main objectives with working with with special populations, is to ensure that they are also assisted in the coping with dealing with their disease or issue. So as we move over to page 515, we're going to talk quickly about the key concept. A lot of times, the special populations are not only going to have just one issue. Typically, they are, most special populations have or anyone that has or is considered a special population typically has more than one condition associated with special populations, such as someone that is overweight might have diabetes, or someone with heart disease might be have high blood pressure, or so there's a lot of transfer and carrying over from one condition to the next as far as exercise guidelines go. So a lot of times the exercise guidelines typically assume that someone with high blood pressure is at risk for cardiovascular disease, so following both protocols is going to be important. And they also will look very similar as far as the recommended guidelines. So one thing also in that key concept on page 515 is that the trainer is going to be encouraged when they end up, a client pays for personal training, and the personal trainer is aware of the condition that they have. It's the trainer's job to increase their knowledge around that special population and further their understanding of the condition that that client may have before continuing. And this is kind of what I mentioned in the sense that I don't have all of this stuff memorized as far as the programming guidelines around certain special populations. I've worked with maybe 200, 300 clients in my life, and only two of them have really been in special populations. One of them had a heart attack about 10 years prior, so it's technically he's in special populations, but he really didn't have any symptoms at all of any, you know, arterial blockage or anything, so it really wasn't even a special population. So, I mean, just keep in mind that depending on where you work and depending on the type of population that you target for your primary clientele, you might be, or you most likely will not be working with a lot of these populations. So I don't want you memorizing all of these guidelines. We're just going to go over them just so that you kind of understand a little bit or some of the risks associated with each disease or condition. And really, yeah, don't stress yourself out about memorizing a lot of this stuff, because really when you get a client, that's when you do the research. That's when you revisit the book and further your knowledge around what you should be doing. And this chapter is pretty good as far as just understanding a little bit about the population and some programming guidelines. But ACSM is really, really the gold standard as far as what exercise programming should look like with special populations. I believe it's called Exercise Guidelines for Persons with Chronic Disease. I think that's the name of the textbook. But ACE actually cites that textbook a lot in this chapter. So. So as we go down into page 515 at the bottom, we're going to get to our first disorder or condition. So once again, guys, I'm going to attempt to explain what the condition is, maybe a little bit about it, and then we're going to discuss the exercise guidelines. I'm going to give you some brief examples of anything that might relate to the field, but I don't want to spend a ton of time in understanding every single aspect of each of these diseases. If you have one of these diseases or conditions, or you're working with clients in the older population that you know have a certain condition, take the time, research it more, and expand your own knowledge. But for the general perspective, most personal trainers will not work with a lot of these populations, so it doesn't need to be memorized, it can just be revisited. All right, so looking at page 515 into 516, first condition that we're gonna go over is cardiovascular disorders, such as things like high cholesterol, coronary artery disease, congestive heart failure, hypertension, stroke, peripheral vascular disease. Those are types of cardiovascular disorders cardiovascular disorders is just a big hood or an umbrella of issues. People are at higher risk for heart attacks. They might not or might have elevated glucose due to diabetes. They might have an imbalance of cholesterol or hormones. They might have higher clotting agents in their blood, which might lead to atherosclerosis, and chest pains, such as heart attack, as well as intermittent claudication, which is like clogged arteries in the extremities. There's a lot of potential diseases that fall under cardiovascular disease. So it's not just one thing, but this is just a general overview. Of if somebody has, we'll say, an issue that was diagnosed by their doctor that is considered a cardiovascular disease, you can refer to this as a tool to help you program. So as we get into exercise and coronary artery disease, they're just going to kind of describe the history, a little bit about it. The coronary artery disease is referring to a clogging of the arteries clogging of the coronary arteries, which are the heart arteries, the arteries that supply the heart with blood. So that is the one that puts you at highest risk for heart attack and increases morbidity or increases mortality. So, reduces mortality. Sorry, a lot of these. Or people in this condition you won't see because most likely they'll be in medically supervised exercise program. I had a client that developed an arrhythmia, and the doctor recommended that he join a program at the hospital as opposed to working with me, which I was completely fine with because oftentimes at the end of the session, he couldn't get his heart rate to drop very fast. It would stay elevated for 10 to 20 minutes, and that was really scary for him. So, and it was also scary for me because I can't really do anything. So yeah, during the end of when we were working together, he ended up having to or being recommended a medically supervised program in which they took a lot more or they took a lot better care of him in the sense of understanding the what he had and the best exercise for that. And to tell the truth, I'm not an expert in special populations, specifically around you know, heart conditions. So I would actually rather refer him to someone else than work with him, regardless of the income that I was getting from him, because it's better for him. And also, you don't want to be there and be training him and have an actual something actually happen and be liable for that. So, all right. So basically, coronary artery disease is typically diagnosed and is with or a typically a graded exercise test is going to be performed by the doctor to determine their functional capacity. That would allow them to create a safe level of exercise recommended by their doctor in which you can follow. Okay, so you might see a client like this after they have had a heart issue for 2 to 3 years. They worked with their doctor to reduce the risk of that heart issue. Now their doctor's finally like, okay, now you can start exercising on your own. And that's when you may run into someone like this. But as we get over to page 517, so basically this textbook is recommending or suggesting that you will only work with clients with very low risk CAD issues or coronary artery disease, meaning that they have a confirmed blockage, but it's not very high and they typically don't see symptoms of that. But to describe what low risk means, the bullet points on page 517 discuss there's no evidence of ischemia. They have a functional capacity greater than 7 mets, meaning they can perform work at 7 mets and not have any issues. They have normal ventricular function. Their heart is pumping correctly, and there's no arrhythmias present. So that's low risk. And specifically, as we get down into that paragraph below those bullet points there, I do want to point out one thing that potentially could be on the test, and that's specifically the recommendations for resistance training for someone with coronary artery disease or with a heart issue. Specifically, they recommend that they use bands, tubings, exercise balls, just free weights, typical, we'll say, tools. But they recommend, and I want you to highlight, that generally clients should perform 12 to 15 repetitions of one set using 8 to 10 exercises. I want you to highlight that and memorize that and associate it with coronary artery disease or any heart issues that a client might have. So once again, one set of 12 to 15 repetitions and about 8 to 10 exercises total. So that's a great way to get blood flow to all areas of the body, enhance the circulation of the heart. And most special populations, actually I'm going to say all special populations, ACE is going to recommend that they use the RPE scale to determine intensity. And specifically, they recommend an intensity of 11 to 14 on the Borg scale, which is the 6 to 20 scale, which is right smack dab in the middle. So, once again, highlight that 12 to 15 repetitions, one set, 8 to 10 exercises, as that could show up on the test. But at the bottom, page 517, you as a trainer, you have to know when you should cease any activity with someone in this special population, and that specifically you should not continue if you see signs such of things like angina, meaning chest pain, dyspnea, lightheadedness or dizziness, rapid heart rate, or excessive heart rate that won't calm down, things like that. Also excessive sweating, tingling in any arm, numbness anywhere on the face or arm, all that stuff should be exercise should cease immediately. Allow the person to recover, and if the recovery does not go well, potentially call 911. And I actually did have to call 911 for one of my clients the client that ended up doing the medically supervised program. That was actually our last session that we worked together. He had had a procedure done to fix the arrhythmia he was having, or the tachycardia, which is the increased heart rate. And he was cleared by his doctor to go exercise again. And when we exercise extremely lightly, actually right in that 12 to 15 repetitions for one set of 8 to 10 exercises, and his heart rate wouldn't calm down. And it stayed high for 10, 15, 20 minutes. And we're talking high in the sense of 150. In a sense, like he's exercising extremely hard, but he's sitting there. So I did have to call the ambulance. They came and took care of him. And that's when his doctor's like, okay, well, since we didn't fix it with the procedure, we recommend that you join a medically supervised program, which, you know, that's definitely scary. So keep in mind that that is a potential with working with any special populations. You might have to go through that. So moving over to page 518, these little boxes, these gray apply what you know boxes, are the main programming points and guidelines that you need to follow for all these special populations. If you understand what the condition is, you can just skip to these gray boxes to understand how to program for these types of clients. So I don't need to spend a ton of time going over the individual, as far as reading, I do want you guys to read all of the apply what you know sections for each of these conditions and highlight what I suggest. But the boxes are the main focus for training clients. That's what you're going to focus on when you have someone one of these special populations. You jump to these boxes. That's what how you should program. So for coronary artery disease or CAD, the mode should be low intensity endurance exercise, low impact, walking, swimming, biking, and basically you should most likely avoid isometric exercises as that could raise blood pressure and put them at risk. One set of 12 to 15 repetitions of 8 to 10 exercises. That should be highlighted in that gray box as well, as that potentially could be a test question. And the intensity that you should perform is going to be 40 to 50% of heart rate or an RPE of 9 to 11. Remember, all special populations, and this is typically most likely making it onto the test for if they ever ask what intensity a special populations person should use, going around hypertension or osteoporosis or around any special population, how should you monitor intensity? Use the RPE scale, specifically the Borg scale of 6 to 20. But yeah, RPE. All right, as they progress, you can move to 60 to 85% of RPE or of heart rate reserve or an RPE of 11 to 14. And these are just all on these boxes. Slowly increase to be able to perform 30 minutes of continuous exercise, or you can start or do some minor interval training and allow for appropriate or additional time for warm-up and cool-downs and appropriate rest. Also, how many days per week? 3 to 5 days per week of aerobic training with 2 days of resistance training. All right, so that's one special population. That's a CAD, only 19 more to go. So I'm going to kind of pick through these a little bit faster. Hopefully, I hit all the main topics that you are concerned with. But next one is going to be hypertension. What is hypertension? They refer to it as the silent killer. But basically, hypertension is high blood pressure. What is high blood pressure? What is the reading? And I want you guys to know this for the field, because anytime someone's blood pressure is over 140 over 90, they need to have a doctor's release in order to exercise. Once again, what is high blood pressure? 140 over 90. Systolic blood pressure is the top number, that's 140. Diastolic blood pressure is the bottom number, that is 90. That's for high blood pressure. Anything higher than that means that the person has high blood pressure and they need to be considered in this special populations category. Okay, normal blood pressure is 120 over 80. Someone can be considered pre-hypertensive when they get above 120 or above 80, but really I'm going to consider that normal blood pressure, as you don't need to create any special programming for this person because they aren't in above or considered hypertensive. All right, so exercise and hypertension. This is one of the best ways to prevent or even reduce blood pressure and prevent this disease from continuing is exercise. And specifically, people will be on blood pressure lowering medication, which we'll get into in a second. But if they're on medication, they can even completely no longer take that medication if they have lowered their blood pressure through exercise and we'll say proper lifestyle. But yeah, you definitely want to work with your with the client's doctor to optimize their lifestyle in order to prevent any or to treat this. And when I say treat, I mean address and program for their special populations or for them as a special population. And recommendations of 150 minutes of exercise per week has been shown to decrease blood pressure. So trying to develop a regular habit of exercise in the 150 minutes or more range is definitely recommended as well. So what types of exercise can effectively lower blood pressure? Well, most likely aerobic training, including just regular steady state cardio, as well as circuit training as we move over to page 519. Circuit training is also effective at lowering blood pressure, and specifically of low to moderate resistance, high repetitions in circuit training is a great way to lower blood pressure and just a great tool to have for someone with hypertension. The key concept I do want to point out, there are some questions that make it onto the test from this section, and specifically, a lot of clients are going to be on medication. Almost all clients that have hypertension are on a medication. The most common medication is beta blockers. You need to know this. They alter the heart rate response by artificially lowering heart rate at rest and lowering exercise heart rate. So you need to know that hypertensives take what's called beta blockers. They alter the heart rate response by lowering, artificially lowering the heart rate at the time. So and also another test question that I kind of already mentioned is that clients in this special population should use the RPE, or the personal trainer should use RPE to monitor the exercise intensity. So use RPE, understand that this population is on beta blockers. Beta blockers alter heart rate. How do they alter heart rate? They lower the heart rate during exercise and lower the heart rate during rest. So if someone's on this medication, you should not do a cardiorespiratory assessment. Also, if someone's on this medication, do not do high intensity training, as their heart might not be able to keep up, and they might get lightheaded, dizzy, and they might fall. So also during the exercise, if someone in special populations has a blood pressure that raises over 250 or systolic or over 115 diastolic, you should cease workouts immediately or take a long rest until their blood pressure drops. Also, we talked about this in the last chapter, but mind-body exercise is great for lowering blood pressure. They recommend yoga and Tai Chi. So in the apply what you know section, what is recommended for people with hypertension as far as exercise recommendations? What are the guidelines? So in the mode is going to be low impact, and almost all special populations are typically going to use a low impact exercise, but low impact aerobic training, walking, cycling, using or on the bike, swimming should be the primary mode. And also isometric exercises should be avoided. And lower resistance, higher repetitions, a circuit training is great. And also yoga and Tai Chi as mind-body exercise can be great for that. How should you monitor intensity? Using the RPE scale, specifically 9 to 13 on the RPE scale is where they should exercise in regarding cardiorespiratory training. And be aware of the heart-altering medications, such as beta blockers. The duration. So you're attempting to get total duration as long as 40 to 60 minutes. But they can start, if they're deconditioned, they can start with 5 minutes and then move up from there. Attempting to get to 60 minutes per day, in any way possible, just maybe 5 minutes at a time, 10 minutes at a time is recommended. And frequency, they should exercise often. Yeah, very often. Doesn't really give, it says, 4 to 7 days per week is the recommendation. So that's high blood pressure. High blood pressure, I do want to talk really quickly just from my perspective on high blood pressure. There's two ways that you can increase your blood pressure, and a lot of people, certain foods can raise blood pressure, we'll say like sodium, But there's two ways that you can raise blood pressure or the pressure in any system, and that's decreasing the space that the blood must flow through, or increasing the fluid volume that flows through the same size hole or the same size tube or artery, we'll say. So a lot of times people say, like, oh, sodium is responsible for high blood pressure. Yes, it is acutely, because when you eat a lot of sodium, your blood volume has to increase because of all the extra sodium. So you add water to your blood. That water to your blood means higher volumes of fluid are flowing through those arterial tubes, increasing the pressure. After about an hour to 2 hours, that pressure reduces because your body balances and normalizes its blood volume. So from a long-term perspective, I'm not a huge believer that high sodium diet will automatically cause low or high blood pressure, but it is recommended by doctors that you avoid high sodium diets if you have high blood pressure, and that's because it acutely raises blood pressure due to the increased fluid volume. So we'll that's a fun fact from Eddie. So the next special population on the middle of page 520 is going to be stroke. Stroke is a term referring to anything that lessens or lowers the blood supply or cuts off the blood supply to the brain. And there's two types of stroke. There's an ischemic stroke in which the blood flow to the brain is going to be cut off due to a blockage, like a blood clot in the brain. And there's also a hemorrhagic stroke in which a blood vessel in the brain bursts, therefore the blood can no longer get to a section of the brain. So brain hemorrhage, they may refer to that as. But they're both types of strokes in which the brain is not getting sufficient nutrients or oxygen due to the fact that the blood vessels heading there, there's an issue with them. In the key concept, that they do want you to understand warning signs of a stroke. And guys, this is good for you just to know for your own sake regarding, when you're hanging out with someone that's older or your parents or, knowing the warning signs of stroke is beneficial, because if you catch a stroke right away, it's less likely to have a major effect on the person's life. If you don't recognize a stroke right away, brain damage typically occurs, leading to major issues with motor function, memory, and potentially even death. So, what are the warning signs of a stroke to know for your clients as well as your life in general and other people that you hang out with? Sudden numbness or weakness in the face, arms, or legs. Specifically, if you see the face start to droop or have no muscle action or muscle activity, that's one of the main things. The confusion or trouble speaking, kind of babbling speech in a sense, like suddenly you're just talking, all of a sudden they can't quite control their speech very well. Trouble seeing, blurriness in both eyes or in one or both eyes, but sudden, where they all of a sudden they get very blurred. And then also walking problems, loss of balance immediately, and then a severe headache with no reason for having a headache, a sudden. All right, so surviving a stroke is quite likely, but its major damage typically occurs to the brain. Because you can imagine if a part of the brain controls, we'll say, your movements, and that a portion of that part of the brain dies, your movements are now going to be altered or hindered, or there's no nervous system communication to those areas of the body. So, the type 2 diabetes increase the risk for stroke, having or unhealthy lifestyles, high stress, alcohol, smoking, all of these things increase the likelihood of a stroke occurring. And as far as exercise and stroke goes, as we move over to page 520, the main purpose for rehabilitation and exercise is to attempt to get the person back doing their activities of daily living. So in the sense of when somebody has a stroke, they typically need full-time care. And the goal is to assist them in reducing that amount of care or removing that care in total. getting them back on their feet. Also, regaining balance and coordination and motor function, as well as performing skills of activities of daily living are important, and to prevent stroke reoccurrence. So, with exercise and with people that have had strokes, improved functional capacity is typically present. Bicycle exercise, water exercise, weight-supported treadmills, and walking, balance and coordination activities are going to be recommended and have shown to improve functional capacity, all of those things. And so it's also exercise is also responsible for increasing other health parameters that will reduce the risk of another stroke occurring too. So with stroke, what are the exercise recommendations? Bottom of page 521. The mode, definitely walking, stationary bike, upper extremity cycle ergometers, water exercise, and also all of it really depends on what motor function they lost during or because of the stroke. If they lost control of their right arm, it's going to be tough to do two-arm recumbent bike, but they can do a single arm. So you have to modify exercise based on their current motor skills or motor functioning. So that's basically what it says there in the mode. Balance exercise and light resistance training definitely should be included. And also you can add cognitive challenges to certain exercises. An example of a cognitive challenge is to think of something specific while performing an exercise. Just challenging their brain beyond just the physical or even something like trying to close one eye or open one eye during an activity can be a further challenge that would assist them in working to get their brain functioning well. Intensity, light to moderate, also depends on their medical history. Obviously, the duration is working towards about 30 minutes of exercise, short bouts of activity. That works to 30 minutes is great. Determine the rest needed depending on their how intense they are feeling. Maybe allow for extended periods of rest. And then frequency is about 5 days per week, and you're aiming for that, but you can start with as little as 3 days per week. So on the bottom of page 521 and on the top of page 522, we're going to get into peripheral vascular disease. So peripheral vascular disease is characterized by a atherosclerotic lesion or basically a blood clot in a peripheral artery. Peripheral meaning legs, arms, somewhere outside of the heart. And basically the blood vessels are going to be blocked, causing, mainly the main point of why this issue is of serious concern is typically it's associated with also having an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, meaning a blockage of a coronary or a atherosclerosis of a coronary artery. And similar to cardiovascular disease or coronary artery disease, risk factors are associated with things like high cholesterol, hyperlipidemia, smoking, diabetes, high blood pressure, genetics, inactivity, obesity, stress, all of those risk factors are pretty common for most special populations or issues, but no difference here. So the what happens with someone with peripheral artery disease is basically they're going to start to feel pain caused by a blocking of an artery, and they're going to feel pain specifically in a muscle. That's because there's a low blood flow to that muscle, and therefore the ability of the muscle to perform work typically is lessened, and that means the ability for the muscle to get oxygen as well as remove waste products. And also get nutrients like glucose and increase, we'll say, energy is lessened or blocked. And that typically results in a cramping or like a spasm in the muscle, and it's called claudication. So intermittent claudication is referring to peripheral vascular disease as well. And most of the time with this population, you're going to be monitoring the pain that they have in the area that has this issue. And those are kind of defined by the scale of table 14-1, which is the four levels of discomfort. Basically, discomfort, but very modest. And then medium discomfort is grade 2. Grade 3 is intense pain, but not quite excruciating. And then grade 4 is unbearable excruciating pain. Your goal is to flirt with pain in that area, but not overdo it. For instance, most peripheral vascular disease or intermittent claudication occurs in the calf muscle, and walking is going to stimulate pain in that muscle because the muscle has lower blood flow. With that in mind, you want to make sure that the person does not have excruciating pain, but you are looking to stimulate pain in that in order to get more blood flow to the area to assist that area with adapting to working harder. And that can help clear that claudication as well. So, with this population, it needs to be diagnosed in order for someone to recognize that they have it. That the signs and symptoms you do need to be aware of if a client complains of cramping in the leg a lot. If you know someone that they wake up often at night due to cramps in the calf, they potentially could have something like this. If they're extremely healthy and they wake up to cramps in the calf, most likely they don't have that issue. But if they're out of shape, overweight, unhealthy, with other issues, and they do experience leg cramping quite frequently while they're lying down or during sleep, that could mean that they have peripheral vascular disease as well, which increases your risk for cardiovascular disease. Okay, but they recommend that walking is the general exercise recommendation. It uses the lower leg muscles, and specifically, this is bottom page 522 and on top of page 523. Ischemia, which they refer to a blockage of the blood, is the stimulus for improving the oxidative metabolism of the muscle. And if you improve the exercise capacity of that muscle, they can perform activities of daily living, such as walking, with less pain. But the main goal is to attempt to get the pain to grades 2 and 3 before stopping. Once it gets to grades 2 and 3, take a rest until the pain goes away. The goal is to try to total about 30 to 60 minutes of work, and you're monitoring pain the entire time. That's kind of the main goal with this disease. If they have too high pain, you need to slow down and take a rest. If they don't have any pain, you need to push a little harder. So, in the key concept, they basically are talking about how peripheral vascular disease is directly related and commonly associated with coronary artery disease. So keep that in mind. And also make sure that they wear appropriate footwear and avoid exercise in the cold air or cold water because of vasoconstriction, the shrinking of blood vessels, which would further inhibit blood flow to that muscle. All right, but the most importantly, what is the general exercise recommendations for someone with PVD? And that's in the Apply What You Know section, bottom page 523. Non-impact endurance exercise, swimming, cycling, and longer duration, higher intensity if they can perform that. Then also weight-bearing exercises is recommended. Walking is the main one that they recommend in shorter duration and lower intensity, and then take long rest periods during pain. And intensity, low to moderate intensities. And then remember, with this specific disease, you're looking to get pain towards the grade 2, grade 3 pain, and then take a rest. And then duration, longer warm-ups and cool-downs, and total exercise duration should be about 30 to 60 minutes, and work up towards that 30 to 60 minute time frame. And then daily exercise is recommended for this population. So not 3 to 5 days, not 5 to 6 days, daily, meaning every day they should be getting out and attempting to do some 30 minutes of activity or more. All right, moving over to page 524. We're getting into dyslipidemia. What is dyslipidemia? It's just a fancy word for high cholesterol or elevated levels of total cholesterol and LDL cholesterol. And specifically, cholesterol has been associated with, or high cholesterol has been associated with heart disease. And specifically, even more important, is that high triglycerides are associated with our heart disease. And in my opinion, I'm not paying attention to cholesterol as much as I am the triglycerides. With triglycerides, they're directly associated with inflammation of the body. And typically, if when people eat higher fat in their diet, they might have elevated cholesterol levels. But if they don't have high cholesterol, if they don't have high triglyceride levels associated with that, they are more or less healthy. So a lot of hoo-ha has been brought to cholesterol as being a really good indicator of if someone's likely to have cardiovascular disease. And unfortunately, that's led to about almost 50% of the population being put on cholesterol-lowering medications. And in my opinion, and a lot of research that I've done through, we'll say, nutrition and heart disease research and or paper studies, all that stuff, cholesterol is less of an indicator to heart disease, and people should not be put on statins or cholesterol-lowering medications in the amounts that they are in. Yes, if somebody has extremely high cholesterol and is unhealthy, that could be a potential option, but that is, it's a little overdone by the medical institution to just jump to put people on cholesterol-lowering medications. Definitely for this population, you want to make sure that they do a good 6 months of exercise before even thinking about being put on a high cholesterol medication. I actually did work with someone that came to me directly from the doctor's office and said, I need to get in shape because my doctor says if I keep up this pace, I'm gonna have type 2 diabetes and high cholesterol and high blood pressure in 2 years. And he immediately started exercising, and within 2 months, he went back to the doctor and everything normalized. So exercise is quite a good, I don't want to say cure, but it's quite a good approach to dealing and reducing the effects of these diseases, specifically around cholesterol, high blood pressure, and type 2 diabetes. So what is cholesterol? It's basically a waxy, we'll say fat-like substance found in the membranes and transported, or cell membranes and transported in the blood. It's an essential component of cellular function, also a component, and produces hormones, vitamin D, and bile acids that are associated with digestion. There's a bunch of different types of cholesterol, and specifically, they're going to list those in the middle of page 524. LDL, you may have heard of. I like to consider those lousy LDL, lousy dense lipoproteins, which is going to be bad cholesterol. When we say bad cholesterol, it's kind of misleading because there's different types of LDL. VLDL is actually, in my opinion, a lot worse than just LDL. VLDL is associated with higher triglycerides, and it's the main carrier of triglycerides. So elevated VLDL basically is associated with higher levels of triglycerides, which is directly linked to heart disease, heart attack, and increased or decreased mortality, higher death rates. So, you don't really need to know too much about LDL, VLDL, HDL, non-HDL, but just kind of general understanding. LDL, they consider bad cholesterol, even though I'd say VLDL is the real bad cholesterol. Because there's different types of regular LDL, and not all of them are bad, we'll say. But VLDL, yes, bad, carries triglycerides. Increased triglycerides are very associated with lack of health. HDL is good cholesterol. Yes, you can consider it good cholesterol in a sense that the higher levels of HDL that you typically have, the healthier the person typically is. I don't want to say it that way, but if the person has normal levels of HDL, they are healthy. That's what I'll say. And then non-HDL cholesterol, you don't really need to know about, but it's an intermediate density lipoprotein. Nobody talks about that. You don't need to worry about it too much. Yeah, in that sense. But exercise associated with having high cholesterol is, yeah, basically going to, yeah, lowering cholesterol is can be done through exercise. And you can reduce non-HDL cholesterol, meaning reduce LDL cholesterol. You can increase HDL, even though there's no direct correlation that they have for increasing HDL with exercise, but lowering the LDL is important, specifically the VLDL. So that's something that's beneficial from exercise. Also, though, keep in mind that in the key concept there on page 525, that the exercise on blood lipids, there's not a ton of corresponding, or typically a reduction in body fat is going to lower cholesterol more than a exercise directly, if that makes sense. So the goal mainly for someone with dyslipidemia is to decrease body fat, as that helps with the high cholesterol. And guys, what is high cholesterol? What are the numbers associated with high cholesterol? Top right, page 525, table 14-3, 14-2, optimal LDL cholesterol is less than 100. Mine actually falls right around actually 130, but that's because I do eat a lot of fat. I am in shape, I exercise often, I eat really well. And because I eat a lot of fat, my LDL total is more near the 130 mark, which puts me at borderline high, but my triglycerides are low, my HDL is high, I'm not worried about it. Total cholesterol, guys, needs to be under 200, and yeah, my total cholesterol is actually below 200 as well, so it doesn't matter too much. But HDL should be greater than 40. Okay. So yeah, greater than 40, less than 100. HDL greater than 40, LDL less than 100, total cholesterol less than 200. Those are the main numbers that you would ever need to know in a conversation about cholesterol. But not necessarily on the test, but I do want you to know under 200 is important because if somebody ever talks to you about that, you do want to understand a little bit about that. And then triglycerides, normal is less than 150. So if you know someone that has their triglycerides red anytime recently, the under 150 is good. If they're over 150, it's increasing the risk for certain diseases. So as we flip over to page 526, we're going to get into the general recommendations for clients with dyslipidemia. And the mode, walking, jogging, cycling, swimming, they're completely appropriate. Resistance training, you're looking at 2 times a week, 10 to 12 repetitions is appropriate. Intensity. Low to moderate intensity with a focus on duration, mainly looking to lengthen the amount of time that they work out, moving from short bouts to longer bouts. Duration is 15 minutes and build to 30 to 60 minutes per day. So frequency 5 days per week or more. They recommend 150 to 200 minutes of total exercise each week, and that's mainly for cardiorespiratory training. And then also your two days of resistance training on top of that. All right. So let's go ahead and get into diabetes after the break, meaning we're going to start a new soundbar down below, and we'll start there and go over diabetes and everything about that and continue on with our special populations. All right, guys, I will see you there. Cheers.